Hello, I'm Rithula Shah. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast from Friday the 20th of November. In a special programme recorded in front of a live audience at the Refugee Studies Centre at Oxford University, we ask whether the attacks in Paris will change Europe's attitudes to refugees, whether too much immigration undermines the fabric of society. And we hear from the US town where 80% of the population are refugee families. Hello and welcome to a special edition of The World Tonight, recorded at the Refugee Studies Centre at Oxford University. We're tackling the question of cohesion and whether increased migration will cause more tension in the communities in which we live. A week ago today, this happened.
My dear countrymen, as I speak, terrorist attacks on an unprecedented scale are taking place in the Paris region.
The terrorists shot at us for like 10 to 15 minutes. It was a bloodbath.
It is an act of war committed by a terrorist jihadist army, Daesh, against France, against the values we defend everywhere in the world.
The reverberations of those terrible events from last Friday will be felt for some time, and their impact on French society, European borders, and the willingness to accept Syrian refugees are only just beginning to be felt. And what if attacks by jihadists on Western targets, be it British tourists on a Tunisian beach, or as happened today, guests in a hotel in Mali, now have to be accepted as a regular occurrence? What effect does that have on how we perceive other communities living in our midst? These are some of the questions we hope to address on tonight's programme. So let's begin by introducing our panel. Saira Grant is Chief Executive of the Joint Council for the Welfare of Immigrants, an independent charity which exists to campaign for justice in immigration, nationality and refugee law and policy. Alexander Betts is the Leopold Muller Professor of Forced Migration and International Affairs and Director of the Refugee Studies Centre here in Oxford. Anout Mehmet is a former diplomat and vice chair of Migration Watch, a think tank that believes immigration is neither sustainable nor well managed. And welcome also to our audience, the majority of whom are here from the university. All the main political parties have been invited, as well as their student associations. Welcome to you all. Let's begin by discussing Paris. It's a city that was shocked by the attack on Charlie Hebdo in January and on a Jewish supermarket just days later. But if those scars had barely healed, they were wrenched open by last week's bloody assault. Saira Grant, is it inevitable that terrorist attacks are going to make us worry rather more about the people in our neighbourhood?
I think it is, to some extent, absolutely. You know, Parisians are putting up a brave front, but of course there's fear. And there's fear in the streets of London as well. It is a sort of inevitable human reaction, but we must look at the reality and look at the facts that these sort of attacks are very rare. And if we change our lives and the way we behave, the way we think, then the terrorists have actually won.
But where does that leave the idea of social cohesion?
Well, it shouldn't damage social cohesion if we have a strong and cohesive society. I mean, fear, in all sorts of ways, you know, knife attacks on the streets of London cause problems for those neighbourhoods and those communities. But communities are strong and communities work together and they work through it. So, yes, there will be a fear impact, but will it have long-lasting damage? I don't think so.
Alt Mehmet, do you see it simply as a fear impact or does it go deeper than that?
I think this one does go deeper. Saira mentions 7/7, then things returned to normal fairly quickly. I fancy this will be linked in people's minds more to 9/11 than 7/7. 7/7, they were all home produced almost. This is slightly different, and it also plays into the wider issue of what is going on in Syria and elsewhere in the Middle East and Islam and the rest of it. So I think that whilst people will go about their lives fairly quickly, normally, I do believe that this one is going to have more of an impact in terms of our longer-term reaction.
Alexander Betts?
I think the worry at the moment is because these attacks take place in the immediate aftermath of a large influx of refugees and migrants, that there's a public and political backlash. We absolutely cannot mix up terrorism and refugees.
Well, let's hear from Parisians about whether they think policy towards Syrian refugees should now change.
France is a welcoming country and we need to stay this way. Terrorism is one thing and refugees is another thing and we need to help them anyway.
I think the government should change its policy towards refugees. We really need to close all the borders, even if it's within Europe, because there's no control now.
I think that France is a beautiful and a rich country and should continue accepting people from Syria. We have to be more human now. I've been there Friday when there was those crazy people shooting at everyone. And yes, I don't feel secure here. I have to live with that now. I won't change my vows in any way.
I'm for re-establishing borders because we live in a new era now, which will last longer than we think. We'll stay European, but we must put up our borders again.
Altmamet, you heard there that last man talking about being in a new era, and particularly as far as our borders are concerned. Is that something that you would identify with and understand?
I think it's probably a new era for France, yes. Inevitably, I think they're going to think rather more carefully. The Schengen arrangement clearly is now beginning to fray at the edges, if not fall apart. I think it probably will. I'm not that sad that that will happen, frankly. But I don't think we should confuse, really, our emotions, our reaction to what has just happened, to the longer-term issue of what we do about refugees, as Alex said. I think there is a difference there. I don't think that we should hold back from providing refuge to all those who need it and deserve it. But what we have to do is actually make sure that the refugees that we take in are genuine asylum seekers. They're not those who are simply using it as a device to get into whatever country they think is going to be a better life in.
But Alexander Betts, if you come back to this idea of fear that we were talking about at the beginning, there have been these emergency talks in Brussels today where they've been discussing how to tighten up border controls within the passport-free Schengen zone, and I think there is some agreement to tighten up controls at the edges. If you put into that fear of who may be passing through, this link possibly with the ringleader of the attack travelling to and fro from Syria, that surely has to build a point of view, build attitudes against migrants and refugees specifically, especially if they're from Syria.
There's a real risk that we overreact if we make policy in a climate of hysteria and generalised fear. And we see that across Europe at the moment, where Schengen is under threat. A number of political parties have moved to question agreements on refugees. The Polish government, for instance, has called into question whether it can commit to the EU-wide quota scheme for refugees. We've seen the CSU to the right of the coalition in Germany putting pressure on Merkel. But I think it's important to stand back, look and recognise that nearly everybody coming to Europe at the moment is from a refugee-producing country.
Sarah Grant, you're championing refugees, but even in the US last night, the House of Representatives voted overwhelmingly to dramatically tighten screening procedures on the refugees they accept from Syria. This is going to get to be a harder and harder argument in the current environment.
Yeah, I mean, yes, it is. But as Alex says, you know, we must step back and not have a knee-jerk reaction and not sort of try and tighten all our policies. Because let's not forget, the refugees who are in Europe are fleeing the same terrorists who perpetrated the attacks in Paris. You know, they're fleeing the same enemy. Now, just because one person or a few people have exploited the free movement and have managed to travel back and forth doesn't mean the hundreds of thousands of refugees that are in Europe are not genuine refugees. So we do have to approach this calmly, thoughtfully. But also let's not forget that a lot of the sentiment that we are now hearing and seeing that's been accelerated was already there prior to the Paris attacks. You know, we've had political differences in how we deal with the refugee crisis.
Altmamet?
Well, just the point that Alex made, it's not just the right that who have qualms about all this and the way it's being done. It's the simply blind attempt to be compassionate, to be welcoming, not really thinking about how to do it, how it's going to be done. That's what people have a concern with. And in Germany, it isn't just the CSU. It's all Germans who are now beginning to have serious doubts about the way it's being done, not that it's being done.
Well, let's look at the situation closer to home. What does community cohesion, a word that's being bandied about increasingly, mean for us here in the UK? Our home editor, Mark Easton, has been looking at the link between social well-being and increased ethnic diversity.
A little over 10 years ago, I interviewed the American social scientist Robert Putnam, who was in London for a meeting with Prime Minister Tony Blair. His best-selling book, Bowling Alone, chronicled the collapse in what Putnam called social capital in the United States, the glue that holds communities together. And it had become a must-read for politicians and policymakers. But in a conversation after the interview was over, Putnam confided to me that he was troubled by the results from more recent research. It appeared, he said, that diversity was bad for social well-being. Whether he shared his concerns with Mr. Blair, whose government was committed to a policy of multiculturalism at the time, he didn't say. But 2 years later, he finally published an article which stated that in the short run, immigration and ethnic diversity tend to reduce social solidarity and social capital. In ethnically diverse neighbourhoods in the US, the paper suggested, residents of all races tend to hunker down. Trust is lower, community cooperation rarer, friends fewer. The findings were seized upon by those who argued it was proof that immigration damaged community life. And very recently, the Home Secretary Theresa May was using the same association to make a political point.
While we must fulfil our moral duty to help people in desperate need, we must also have an immigration system that allows us to control who comes to our country. Because when immigration is too high, when the pace of change is too fast, it's impossible to build a cohesive society. It's difficult for schools and hospitals and core infrastructure like housing and transport to cope. And we know that for people in low-paid jobs, wages are forced down even further, while some people are forced out of work altogether.
But not everyone agrees. Since Putnam's article, a number of academic studies have questioned whether his theories apply to the UK. Indeed, they challenge his central assertion that diversity and immigration cause community trust to decline. Would people trust the other people in their neighbourhood any more if it was somehow possible to create ethnically homogeneous communities? Hardly at all, found one paper. Could it be that ethnic diversity actually improves social cohesion once social and economic factors are removed from the equation? A number of studies assert that it does. Is the impact of diversity different for different age groups? Yes, says a study looking at London, where it found a strong positive effect on young people, but less so in older age groups. It is a contested area of research, with arguments about what we even mean by diversity or cohesion. Communities that are highly segregated by nationality or ethnicity experience very different outcomes from those with more mixing. Which brings us back to Robert Putnam. His article, linking greater diversity with lower social capital, suggests that only applies in the short term. In the long run, he states, immigration and diversity are likely to have important cultural, economic, fiscal, and developmental benefits. So if that's right, would politicians, and indeed voters, be prepared to put up with short-term tensions in the hope of gaining longer-term benefits?
Mark Easton there. Sarah Grant, how would you describe the sort of sense of community cohesion in the UK?
I actually think we have a lot to be proud of in the UK. We have good community cohesion on the whole. We really are a success story of multiculturalism. We do not have the problems that we do see, say, in France or in Belgium. It's very interesting, a very recent study in November, a global study, November 2015, showed that the sense of belonging amongst migrant pupils in France is the lowest amongst all the countries studied, and this was a global study. Belgium was followed second. Very interesting in the wake of what's happened, because if there is a sense of belonging, you feel integrated. If you call a place your home, a place where you belong, you're very unlikely to blow it up. And that is a very sort of simple concept, but absolutely pivotal. Without integration, without a sense of belonging, there is a real danger that people feel alienated, and it leads to the sort of radicalisation that we have seen.
Alp Mehmet, would you say that the UK is a socially cohesive society?
It is at the moment, yes. First of all, let's be clear. What we're talking about is mass immigration. We're not talking about immigration being good or bad. Look at this room. Look at this table here. Three of us here are products of policies of the past that brought people to this country. I have no problem with that. But it's absurd to suggest that the scale of immigration as it is at the moment is not going to have an impact. Mark, in his piece, says that the ethnic diversity actually improves social cohesion once social and economic factors are removed from the equation. That's a ridiculous thing to say.
Well, he's stating the arguments.
It's an argument that I find absurd. It's like saying, we played a game of football, we actually lost 2-1, but if you take away the two goals that the other scored, we won. Well, that's ridiculous.
No, that's not what he's saying at all.
Well,
that is
the implication of what he says. And what Robert Putnam actually said originally is something that Professor Paul Collier has also said in his book Exodus, that it does, in the first instance and for a period, there is a loss of trust, was how he put it. And that, again, is inevitable. Now, if you're going to say that in the end all will be well, when? How long will it take for it to be okay?
Sarah Grant.
So I don't understand why a loss of trust is inevitable. That makes no sense to me whatsoever. And the point that Mark Easton was making was about income inequality. That is a big factor that plays a part in social cohesion. It's not race, background, culture. It is about economic deprivation, and that is the biggest cause of hostilities amongst communities. That's why when you remove that, when you're talking about level playing field, sort of equal opportunities of jobs, education, etc., for everybody, then you find that integrated and diverse communities actually do very well, and there is no problem with social cohesion.
Is that happening? And are we? What we're looking at is 636 thousand people at the last count came to this country over the past year. A lot of them don't speak the language, they don't understand the country. Are you saying to me that it doesn't really matter how many people come in, that we will be able to do the same with all of them, that they will be able to enjoy the sort of opportunities that I have had? Is that what you're saying? Because if you are wrong.
Sarah Grant, David Blunkett has said that one of his regrets was that he didn't perhaps better prepare communities that were going to receive large numbers of migrants. There are issues, aren't there, of integration, of people getting used to one another?
Absolutely. And I go back to my point about income inequality. Of course we have to prepare. And the biggest problem is, for a community, its infrastructure. You know, if a large volume of people come where there's no preparation and there's a shortage of housing and schools, etc., of course it's a problem. And then that will impact the sort of feelings people have against those people who have come. So of course there needs to be planning. But I completely disagree with you, Alp. I do not think that we've got unsustainable numbers. I mean, in the days of Charles Dickens, when he was in the slums of London, if you told him that in 2015 our population would be close to 64 million, he would have, you know, absolutely stopped doing everything he was doing, because he really believed London was overcrowded and wouldn't survive, and there would be tensions amongst communities and everybody would end up killing each other. That, of course, hasn't happened, because we can cope. It's all about how we perceive our neighbours and what policies our government advocates.
Sarah,
that is a key point.
The population growth at the moment is totally unprecedented. In 1851, when we had the first census, we had a foreign born population of 1.5%. In 1951, 100 years later, it was 4.3%. Yeah. In 10 years between 2001 and 2011, it went from something like 4.3% to almost doubling to 7%. It's the speed with which it's happening that you can't cope with.
Professor Betts in, but before I do, Altman, what do you think the government could do, in your view, then, to deal with that? Are the numbers simply too overwhelming, or could governments actually try and ease integration?
Well, I think it's all linked. What we could do is actually have immigration at lower levels, and that is possible. It can be done. It has been done. And I think it would be the wisest and kindest thing to do that, to bring immigration down as the first instance.
Professor Betts, we talked a little bit about the sort of arguments that have been raised in the academic sphere. Where does that debate stand about how numbers of people arriving in a country affect social cohesion?
There's a real tendency amongst policymakers to abuse social science. I think the academic literature on the relationship between social cohesion and immigration is mixed. As Mark Easton highlighted, there are broadly two competing effects. A threat effect, where people within a country often feel a sense of competition that leads to a decline in trust. But on the other hand, a contact effect. The more people interact with one another, the more they mix, the more trust and intergroup interaction emerges, and you get greater social cohesion. Putnam's study only focused on the first of these, and it came to the conclusion of a hunker-down hypothesis, where people withdraw away from community with diversity. That's been discredited in studies on the UK. A recent study in the European Sociological Review by Lawrence and Bentley highlights that if you look longitudinally, there are massive positive intergroup interaction effects when people get to know one another. And that's one of the reasons why in the UK, some of the greatest areas of tolerance for immigrants are areas like London, which have the greatest immigration. And the areas with the lowest tolerance for immigration are those with the fewest interactions with migrants and the least ethnic diversity. So everything supports basically what Mark Easton fleshed out, that the more interaction we have, the more trust builds, and the more social cohesion you see over the long term. And that means it's in our hands. It's in the hands of policymakers, political decision makers. If we have the right policies for those that we integrate and the right policies for host communities, we provide schools, education, infrastructure, and we support that integration process, it can work.
I want to move on because, as I think we've been discussing, the challenge of assimilating refugees or other immigrants can be most pressing when large numbers are involved. And there's always the danger that they form ghettos cut off from the rest of the population. And yet some argue that putting new arrivals together in one town or city can actually help them to settle in and adapt to a new country. And one place they've tried this is the southern United States town of Clarkston. Now, once upon a time, Clarkston had a mostly white population. In fact, it was a local bastion of the Ku Klux Klan. But after a program to resettle refugees there was introduced, it became, in just 30 years, a town where 80% of the population are now either refugees themselves or their offspring. So does it work? The World Tonight's Paul Moss visited Clarkston.
It's become a major community event. Once a year, Clarkston in Georgia shuts out traffic and holds a street festival which celebrates this town's diverse population. There were fabrics, foods and costumes from around the world. And the music, well, that was actually very American. It wasn't the best day for a festival this year, with an unseasonal cold wind blowing and rain pouring down. But everyone seemed determined to try and have fun and to tell me what it is they celebrate here.
Clarkston is very diverse. I'm learning the way of life here. You know, coming from Uganda, my culture is totally different, you know. But here, I want to say that I feel part of the community.
I've just ducked into a stall run by a group of refugees from Bhutan who've given me a cup of their hot tea. And I'm here with Birka Gurugay. Birkan, have you been made to feel as a refugee coming to this town?
I told Americans we spent our life in camp with no food. When I tell the stories to Americans, I found a lot of them who like to listen to the stories of refugees.
And that's important.
That's the whole thing, that we feel that we're getting respect.
Refugees have been telling their stories here in Clarkston since the 1980s. First, it was Vietnamese who came here, the so-called boat people. Bosnians arrived in the 1990s, and then later Eritreans, Burmese and other nationalities, all placed in housing that became vacant when their owners grew more affluent and moved out. The idea was that rather than dispersing refugees around the country, it made sense, at least initially, to put many of them in one place.
If they're all together, they can learn English together, they can receive services together. It's helpful for the people serving, the refugee serving agencies.
Cassie Lamery is a social scientist who wrote about Clarkston for her doctoral thesis at Georgia State University.
Many of the refugees experience post-traumatic stress disorder, that type of thing, so it's easier to resettle refugees in a place where they already have community members or people that understand, you know, their way of life and where they're coming from.
All right, so we just have to make an account.
A host of community organizations have been set up here to help refugees, like Cafe Clarkston, where new arrivals are put in touch with potential employers.
Whenever you have to apply for anything else, they'll have...
Cafe Clarkston is run by Brian Bollinger, who explained to me that finding a job for refugees is often the easy bit. The real challenge, he says, is teaching people the more nuanced understanding they'll need to fit in at work in a new country.
There are going to be certain immigrants who are going to arrive from countries where they've never had a boss who was a woman. Or they're going to come and they've never had someone who was their supervisor who was of a different race or skin color. If you're not equipped with at least a basic working knowledge, you're going to say something that is going to... at the very least, make you a pariah, if not get you into a fist fight.
Well, this is where the children of refugees, or children who are refugees, come. This is Clarkston High School, which must be one of the most diverse educational establishments in the world. There are 53 nationalities here, they tell me, speaking 65 different languages.
Tell me what the ideas were. Raise your hand so that I can call on somebody.
Teacher Amy Jarrett has been taking her pupils through the American Revolution. But she and her colleague Julie Goldberg told me they found the best way to help refugee children feel part of their new country is to talk about the history and culture of the countries they fled from.
Honestly, I don't know that I've ever really thought about my job as making people feel American so much as creating an atmosphere in which they share their cultural background and experiences with other people in the room.
I think it's about finding how you fit in into the broad fabric of America.
There are people in Clarkston who believe that some refugees will never fit in and that they've changed this typical southern US town beyond recognition. I went for a drive with local resident Phil Kent, who showed me a street where Somalis have been living.
We're now driving through this Brandon Hill condo complex. Unfortunately, controlled by a Somali gang. You can see that this was once a nice condominium complex. Now there's some burned out areas that we just saw. Look at the garbage that's piled up here. This is the really dark side of the refugee resettlement here in Georgia. Frankly, some of the refugees can be assimilated, all too many cannot. It's a balkanized area.
It was strange to hear a similar complaint of that balkanized-style social fragmentation from a Somali woman. Othan Osman was speaking to me in a local Somali restaurant in Clarkston, her table covered with plates of spicy meat dishes, several kinds of rice and vegetable. But despite the feast on offer, Othan pointed out to me that only Somalis were eating there. And in general, she said, different refugee communities tend to stick to themselves.
I have visited a Nepalese restaurant and I find that people are staring at me because I'm not one of them. And even within the Muslim community, you have the Somalis who go to one particular mosque and then the Arabs, they go to a separate mosque.
So this image of being this perfect American melting pot, you don't buy it?
No, I do not buy into that melting pot. It's not butterflies and rainbows and we're all holding hands. And I mean, it's an ideal, but reality is different.
Back at the street festival, Amar played me some music from his native Iraq and told me to be patient. The melting pot would come, he said. It's just that it's a work in progress.
There's a new generation right now. They are interacting between each other. We will witness Iraqi people who marry Ethiopian women and vice versa. Let's imagine how their kids will be. That will create a new culture. And that's something good for humanity.
Paul Moss reporting from Clarkston. Syra Grant, that's a US example, but what it does illustrate very clearly that there are limits of acceptance amongst all communities.
That was a very interesting piece, actually, because many studies have shown that ethnic segregation, which is what is happening in Clarkston, actually reduces social cohesion. And it's interesting what Alex was saying about contact. And the difference between the two is that diversity improves social cohesion. But if you have communities that ethnically just stick together and you have that divide, where there is no intermingling between communities, then there is a real problem with social cohesion, and that's what we've seen there. I mean, that's what we have so effectively not done in London, which is the most diverse of our cities. There are strong communities within London. I mean, the Afro-Caribbean community, for example, and there are pockets of London where different communities are in the majority, but there is intermingling, there is contact. And I mean, the Notting Hill Carnival, for example, you know, a fantastic display of Caribbean culture, which is attended by most of Londoners of all walks of life and cultures and
diversity. Are other cities in the UK that are far more segregated.
Yes, there are. And in terms of integration, we have to make sure that there is no ethnic segregation. I think that is really important.
But how do you do that? Because I think the thing that you saw in that piece was that people actually like to be with people of their own type.
Well, that, of course, and that is all about a sense of identity. You know, everybody wants to be in a situation with people where they feel they belong, and that's what I go back to. So if we have a society where people do belong, people do feel integrated, then we do away with those barriers. But can I make one more really important point? The tone of our country and of our communities is led by our politicians. When we have a government that is actively pursuing a hostile environment, which is what we have seen this government do, we had an Immigration Act last year where the entire purpose was to create a hostile environment for illegal migrants. We have an immigration bill going through Parliament now, straight after that, again, to strengthen that hostile environment for illegal migrants. That, all those policies, and obviously we don't have time right now to talk about them, but they're all about making civil society border guards. When you have policies like that, and when our leaders are talking about hostile environments, that does nothing for cohesion.
Outnumbered, is it a hostile environment, or is it a government perhaps reflecting public opinion?
Both, probably. I'm not sure that it's that hostile, whatever the government tried to do. And I don't disagree with anyone who wants to see a society that's at ease with itself, is happy. But as Horfan Osman said in that clip, frankly, it's not rainbows and holding hands and kissing and hugging each other. We're talking about human beings, people, and it's no good ignoring that they've all got their little failings and their problems, be it those who've just arrived or those who are already here. We're talking about bringing people together. And all I'm saying is that at the present rate, with this scale, it just becomes almost impossible. And it's all very well to point to London, to say, yes, but London is more tolerant. Yes. But what sort of people are there in London? The mix is very different to the mix that was here when I arrived in the mid-50s.
Does that matter, that it's different?
Well, 75% of the people of this country think it does. There are 75% of people in Britain who think that immigration is too high. You can't simply brush aside those concerns.
One quick question then, which I'm going to pick up with Alexander Betts. We've talked a lot about the numbers of people that have come into this country. Do you assume that everybody will stay?
Yeah, my parents, when they arrived, they had an idea that they would go back, having made their little pile, and build their home and whatever in Cyprus. When the opportunity came, the last thing they wanted to do was leave this country. It's unrealistic to think that many of them will go back. They don't. Why should they? Their lives are here, as my life is here.
Alexander Betts, when you talk about refugees specifically, as opposed to perhaps people arriving as immigrants, expecting perhaps to change their lives, is there evidence to suggest whether people stay or whether they leave?
I mean, there's past evidence about whether refugees stay or go. I mean, in theory, the idea of asylum is to provide people with temporary sanctuary until they're able to go home. Now, if their societies aren't rebuilt and restructured, they can't go home, and that leads to long-term exile. But we know, for instance, from cases like the Bosnian example, that nearly 95% of Bosnians went home, and that was because we contributed to rebuilding those societies, and with the possibility to do so, people went back. Whether Syrians will go back is not an inevitable outcome. It depends on our ability to rebuild Syrian society to make that possible. I think the other point I'd make, though, is the nature of mobility is changing. More and more people move in circular migration. People move temporarily within the European Union. People maintain transnational attachments and have transnational identities. And so the way in which people move for work temporarily, for social reasons, to travel, is changing. And that applies to all of us within British society, to other people within Europe and globally. And so I think we have to change our attitudes towards migration to align with the realities of globalization and the 21st century.
I want to end by asking each of you a very quick question. Do you feel optimistic then, given the sort of tensions that exist, the fact that people are much more worried about immigration now than they were, say, 5 or 6 years ago, do you feel optimistic that the UK can remain an integrated and cohesive society? Saira Grant.
We need to ensure that we do not create hostile environments for ourselves. That is absolutely wrong. We also need to make sure that people feel welcome and they feel that they belong. And when that happens, when communities interact, what you have is what I have, which is two children who have an Asian mother and a Scottish father. Now, they completely feel they belong in this country, and I really hope there's more of that.
Alexander Betts, do you feel positive that we will come out of this phase and remain a cohesive society?
British values have been open and inclusive for a long time. We've integrated many people throughout the period after the Second World War, South Asians in Windrush, Ugandan Asians. We've tolerated and included refugees from after the Second World War throughout much of the 20th century. And so I think it's important to recognise British identity is diverse, it is mixed, and social cohesion is built on that diversity.
Alt Mehmet.
I'd like to be optimistic. I think that if numbers come down, then we can manage it. My problem is that the way I see things going at the moment is going to become increasingly difficult.
That's all we have time for from this special edition of The World Tonight. Thank you very much to all our guests, Alt Mehmet, Saira Grant, Alexander Betts. Thanks also to our hosts here at the Refugee Studies Centre at Oxford University and to our audience. I'm Ritha Lashar from everyone on the programme. Good night.